It's Saturday, November 4th, 2006. This is PodTech Weekly. I'm Jason Lopez.
Hacking, the insertion of attacks, some kind of attack software program, was the risk to be most concerned about because it could affect so many votes.
Midterm elections are upon us. 6 years after the hanging Chad, voting machines are still under the microscope. We also scrutinize game consoles on this edition of PodTech Weekly. And Catherine Girardeau visits the Women in Technology Summit to gather some compelling insights into global warming. Those stories on this edition of PodTech Weekly. This week, it was announced that there are now more than 100 million websites. It's quite a milestone for Tim Berners-Lee, the main man behind the language and protocols that have made the web what it is today. Berners-Lee is now busy trying to make the web even better. Earlier this week at MIT, he and his colleagues announced that they were forming a new field of academic study. It's called Web Science. PodTech's Clark Boyd was on hand for the announcement.
Tim Berners-Lee began his speech by praising what computer science has made possible in the past few decades. It's enabled us, Berners-Lee said, to create the microscopic infrastructure of the web, to design how machines talk to each other. But the web, he said, has grown in ways he could never have dreamed of.
The web is a web basically of people, people and companies. It's a way that social entities interact. So when we use computer science to talk about it, obviously we're only using a little bit, one little faculty of the very many things that we have to bring to bear on it. So what should we do? We should understand it. We have a duty to understand it, because suppose from among all the beautiful, wonderful things it's producing, it produces some horrible things. Because it's something we created, we have a duty to make sure that if we can make it better, we do make it better.
Toward that end, Berners-Lee announced the creation of the Web Science Research Initiative.
As with the original web, the goal of anything we're going to do is social. The goal is to make something which serves humanity, to enable humanity. We're creating, if you like, a sort of composite, a humanity which is now enabled with these new forms of communication. And we want to make sure it's the place that we would like to be. Remember, we're doing engineering too. So this is science in the sense of computer science. A lot of computer science is analytical, but fundamentally it's synthetic. Computer science is about building things. So web science is about building things. It's about building a new web, building a better web, and it's about building things on top of the web infrastructure. And it's about how we can make the web infrastructure, this sort of space in which things happen, a richer space, a more powerful space out of which we can construct new, exciting things.
The Web Science Research Initiative will be a shared project between MIT and the University of Southampton in Britain. Nigel Shadbolt is professor of artificial intelligence at Southampton. He said that web science will be an interdisciplinary field, drawing together social scientists, economists, lawyers, public policymakers, computer scientists, and even biologists.
When we look at how people are trying to understand protein networks, trying to understand communication in nervous systems, in other biological systems, there are tools and methods and insights that we believe could be very valuable to our understanding the structure of the web itself and the internet underlying it.
It's a big and admittedly amorphous idea for now. After the announcement, a few reporters got the chance to ask one-on-one questions. We wanted to get some more concrete examples of what the Web Science Research Initiative will study, or things it might try to engineer. One of the reporters asked it this way: what problem is web science trying to solve? Danny Weitzner is a principal research scientist at MIT who's involved in the project. He took the first crack at an answer.
If you ask the question of computer science, what problem are you trying to solve? You would say, well, you want computers to work better. You want them to do what they're expected to do. And you don't want them to break. Right? And so in some sense, we hope the same thing for the web. We want to understand how the web functions as a web. We want to understand what's the next PageRank algorithm. So PageRank was Google's algorithm was a single example of modeling the relationship of pieces of information on the web and getting a useful result, understanding, in that case, how to find pages that were relevant to a text query, right? Now, there are a lot of other ways, certainly, to find information on the web. In order to do that, we have to continue to develop models of how information on the web is related to what people are looking for. We can give a lot of examples. Take security, for example. We've tried to solve security problems on the web at the internet level. We've tried to say, let's have secure transport between a particular individual and a website. Let's try to create systems with digital certificates so we can identify people clearly. Well, those are internet-based solutions. They're solutions that are good at dealing with the security of a channel between a single person and a single site, maybe with some third-party certifying things. The web's not like that, though. What we've seen already is that those solutions are not scaling onto the web. We have phishing problems. We have spam problems. We have blog spam. And in order to deal with problems like that, we have to understand the web as a system.
Southampton's Wendy Hall, who heads the School of Electronics and Computer Science there, also took a stab at the question.
If you take an eBay or Amazon, they only work because lots of people use them. And these ideas, when you have them, if you imagine eBay with just a handful of people using it, it's not a desperately exciting system. But when you have millions of people around the world using it, it becomes a phenomenon. And that's what you cannot predict how these things are going to evolve. And that's really what we're trying to study. We want to throw some light on forecasting, in a way. That's not going to be an exact science, but it's the forecasting of what these new technologies might lead to in the human sense, in the community sense, and the business sense as well. We mustn't forget that. New businesses will start as a result of that.
Then Tim Berners-Lee weighed in.
I think the question is a strange one, because you can't ask of computer science what is the problem which it was created to try and solve. We're looking at this huge new complex thing, this complex system that we've to a certain extent created, but in fact for which we really just created the underlying infrastructure and the underlying rules, and it sort of created itself out of the mass of humanity. Humanity has created it in a collaborative fashion. So we're trying to understand it. And we have the ability to change that underlying infrastructure. We have the ability to start new ideas for new things which will happen on it. And all of these are very exciting. When you open a whole new research area, you ask a lot more questions than you solve answers. And always one of the characteristics of that is every time we write a program to solve a particular problem or to demonstrate something's really possible, then we find that when we write it up that we're asking a whole lot more questions about what else is possible than we're actually solving with that one particular step.
Asked about internet governance. I wondered, with the Internet Governance Forum wrapping up in Athens this week, whether the idea of a balkanized or fractured internet might be a subject of study in web science. Tim Berners-Lee began by reminding me that web technology rides on top of the existing internet technology.
When we do web science, we'll be looking at things we can do above the internet level, but we must definitely talk because the requirements we'll have for building different shaped systems at the web level clearly affect the things that are going to happen at the internet level. So if there are upsets in how the internet's managed, then clearly it could upset the web. But hopefully, because the web's a neutral medium, changes in the internet level won't affect the websites you can go to. They won't have an effect on the politics people do on that and so on. There is the one area which tends to be at the center of most of the discussions about internet governance, is the domain name system. And the curious thing about the domain name system, which in fact has been very useful, but it also has been, if you like, the Achilles heel of the whole system, is that unlike the net, which is a network, and the web, which is a web, it's a tree. It has a root. It has a single root of the dot, which starts at the top-level domains. And so in order to register a new domain, you have to register with somebody who has been registered with somebody who's registered with somebody who owns the top. And so socially, that piece is actually hierarchical as opposed to web-like. And that is where there's, if you like, a grinding, that the decentralized communities starting up all by themselves suddenly find they have to pay money for a web page, for a domain. And of course, anybody who runs as you suggest in your question, anybody who runs the top level of the domains could, in principle, mess around with them. In fact, so much depends on the good running of the domain name system that I'm hopeful that they will continue to run smoothly. And in fact, when normal people go out and want to get a domain, there are such a lot of them out there, so many domains you can think of, that they'll continue to be inexpensive, and they won't really be constrained on the spread of web technology.
Certainly an area of research that interests us, that we think is a part of web science, is exploring new network transport methods that could underlie the web. So the web, as Tim says, obviously depends today on the DNS. That therefore leads to the political problem. As you know, the major debate in Athens was who controls the dot, right? And it's currently the U.S., and there are, I think, efforts to share the control somewhat more. But in some sense, it may well be a resource that really shouldn't be controlled by anyone. There are obviously liabilities to the U.S. or a U.S. corporation controlling the dot. There are probably liabilities to the U.N. controlling the dot, too. I think there are liabilities to any political process controlling that essential part of the infrastructure. If we could learn something from peer-to-peer technologies, for example, maybe we could figure out how to support the whole infrastructure of the web without having to have this single point of failure, this single point of political vulnerability, and this single point of contention.
MIT and Southampton intend to fund the Web Science Research Initiative through a combination of donations and partnerships with large corporations. Although none of the officials would say which companies might be interested, both Google and IBM have publicly endorsed the idea. One reporter ended the press conference by asking Tim Berners-Lee what benefits the everyday web user might get from any work done by the project.
Many things today, if you like, that we've seen have been produced from people getting an understanding of what's happening on the web. And the things they've created have made the web, they've added to the web, they've made these new systems which have made the web. So you're asking us now to say, okay, so what's the user going to see when we do now 5-10 years of research and produce new things? Well, you know what? When I started the web, I couldn't have predicted the things people have done. And in fact, what's really important about it is that it's such an exciting creative space that there's no way that the people sitting around this table will be able to predict what happens. We want to make sure, if you like, our job is to make sure it is the maximally creative, maximally powerful place in which to design new things.
One last note to pass along. MIT and Southampton have agreed that any research conducted by the Web Science Research Initiative will be done on an open source basis. In Boston, this is Clark Boyd for PodTech News.
You can access the Web Science Research Initiative at webscience.org. This is PodTech Weekly. Global warming looms large on the agenda this month at the polls, in the press, and at gatherings of business leaders. California voters head to the polls November 7th to vote on a slew of ballot initiatives, including Proposition 87, which aims to tax oil to fund alternative energy incentives and research. Climate change was one of the main themes at the Women in Technology Summit, a gathering of mostly female technologists and business leaders held in Santa Clara, California last week. A government scientist, an entrepreneur, and a CEO of an electric car company talked about the challenges and opportunities of global warming. PodTech's Catherine Girardot is at the conference and brings you voices from the climate change panel.
Although the Bush administration continues to insist there is no scientific proof that global warming is a threat to the planet and is leaving the rest of the Kyoto Treaty signers to do what they can to reduce the world's carbon emissions, Hurricane Katrina woke the country up to the possibility that climate change might actually pose a real threat to Americans and to the American economy. California voters are headed to the polls next week to vote on a slew of ballot initiatives, including Proposition 87, which says it aims to tax oil to fund alternative energy incentives and research. It's no surprise that climate change was one of the main themes at a conference on women in technology I attended in Santa Clara last week. A government scientist, an entrepreneur, and the CEO of an electric car company talked about the challenges and opportunities of global warming. Dr. Peter Tons, senior scientist with the Earth System Research Laboratory at NOAA, Sierra Dahl, president and CEO of Challenge International, a company that brings businesses together to discuss renewable energy, and Martin Eberhard, CEO of Silicon Valley electric car company Tesla Motors, gave an hour-long presentation to the conference attendees. PodTech News brings you this collage of choices.
It is possible that since we are warming, especially the Arctic right now, this is very clearly happening, that we may actually trigger something that is out of our control. Permafrost, another word for that is permanently frozen soil. There is an estimated amount of between 500 and 1,000 billion tons of carbon is locked up in permafrost. Now, as the Arctic warms, what is now ice will become soggy and swampy, and you can see the results. Buildings will collapse, a forest is falling over, because you know the trees and the house loses its footing. But what's worse, what will happen to that organic matter when it first thaws out and then eventually dries out? We all expect it will turn into gas, first methane and then eventually carbon dioxide. So it is possible that the melting of the permafrost will add 1,000 tons, three times as much as we have already emitted ourselves during the entire industrial period. And this would be out of our control. This is a risk that we take.
What's happening in the United States? In 2004, we had about $105 billion of weather-related economic losses. And Katrina, as Dr. Tons showed you, farmers' crops were leveled to cost them around $2 billion. Prices rose as a result of all of this for everything, just about. Transportation costs went up. The cost of everything we do, the food, clothing, and everything has gone up as a result of Katrina. Insurance rates rose. Okay, drought, 41%, 45% of the United States, the contiguous United States, has been in drought. 8.8 million of acres of forest have burned in the United States this year.
The International Energy Agency estimates that to just meet the expected energy demand for the year 2030, we'll need global investment totaling $20 trillion. That's actually not all that much. Translated towards the U.S. share, that would be $200 billion a year or so. The actual cost is likely to be larger than that because the International Energy Agency is estimating this with conventional technology. But I'm talking about new technology. We need carbon-free energy sources. We need a complete reformation, complete rebuild of our energy system. So it might cost, in U.S. terms, of the order of $400 billion a year. I compare that to the Pentagon budget, which is something like $450 billion a year. And I think it's a proper comparison because this is an issue of national and international security. And I just, not as a scientist, but as a fellow citizen, I think we should have a national debate on our priorities. Do we spend it on weapons of mass destruction, or do we invest it in our real security?
Aware, there used to be a thing called the zero emissions mandate. You remember that? Remember electric cars around in the late 90s? These were, for the most part, conversions of existing cars, and for the most part, with the exception perhaps of the GM car, they were... Among the people who didn't like these cars were the people who made them. Instead of spending their money on creating great electric cars that we could all drive, they mostly spent their money on lobbying and suing the state of California. And their work paid off. In 2003, the zero emissions mandate was killed in California, and all these cars were taken off the road immediately. If you had the misfortune of having leased your car, such as with the GM EV1 or some of the others, you had your lease canceled, the car taken back, and it was crushed. You've already seen your last EV1. There are no more on the road. General Motors and the other car companies argued that there wasn't a market for electric cars enough to make it worth their trouble, and that these cars only appealed to basically the tree huggers and the geeks.
So here's the good news. Right now is a time of tremendous opportunity for business.
Tesla Motors invents the notion of the performance electric car, trying to make electric cars appeal to more than just the technology enthusiasts and the environmentalists.
Here's what your company can do. Don't travel. You don't have to. You can web conference. Give employees incentives in your company to come up with new ideas on waste. You can think of new products and services for the market, new energy sources. You can come up with energy-saving technologies and appliances. You can come up with all kinds of goods that are built from recycled materials. New forms of transportation.
With a car today, you have a choice. You can have performance or you can have efficiency. Pick one. And Tesla Motors says, no, pick two. It is 0 to 60 in about 3.9 seconds. highway driving range of about 250 miles, well-to-well energy efficiency of something like 135 miles to the gallon. It costs about a penny per mile to drive if you're charging at night using time-of-use meter.
Here's what's happening in countries worldwide. Europe. Europe is way ahead of us. They figure that in Europe, about half of the wind power should be there by 2020 to power half of Europe. Sweden is planning on being totally oil-free by 2020. Here's something that's happening over in Scotland. It's the Plamas system developed, and it is a series of tubes that go around the outside of Scotland, and they're actually capturing wave energy.
So with that, I'd like to quote Sheikh Yamani, the man who founded OPEC. He said, "The Stone Age came to an end not for lack of stones, and the oil age will come to an end not for lack of oil." And I think this is what he's talking about.
And I'll end with this one. To indicate that it is possible, look at Sweden. Sweden, as a country, decreased its CO2 emissions per capita by a factor of 2 in 2 decades. And they did not collapse. Thank you.
Thoughts on climate change from the Women in Technology Summit in Santa Clara, California, October 29th through 31st. In San Francisco, I'm Catherine Girardeau, PodTech News.
This is PodTech Weekly. I'm Jason Lopez. Voting day is Tuesday the 7th. It seems a day doesn't go by without a report of another security flaw in the nation's electronic voting system and its vulnerability to tampering or voter fraud. PodTech's Matt Kelly looks at the issue and files this report.
With Tuesday's 2006 midterm elections just days away, millions of Americans will put new electronic voting machines to the test. These machines will count more than three-fourths of the votes cast in America's election. But can voters trust the new systems? In one of the first major tests of the election overhaul after the 2000 presidential election, voters will head to the polls and confront new electronic voting technology, along with its potential security flaws as they cast their ballots. They'll confront questions about paper trails, provisional and absentee ballots, new voter registration and identification rules, and a host of other concerns, all hot-button issues that could spur concerns over the legitimacy of the election's outcome. The stakes are high. If the voting process isn't secure, neither is America's democracy, says Larry Norden, associate counsel at the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law.
The Brennan Center works to promote effective democracy. We work in a lot of areas of elections and voting rights. And we were concerned that there has been such a transformation in how we vote in this country in the past 4 or 5, 6 years that the right procedures might not be in place for these machines. There's a lot of public discussion about the fact that these machines weren't safe, that they weren't recording votes accurately. So we decided to look at how vulnerable these machines were to attack, not just to hacking, but to all kinds of attacks and other problems. And what we did find in the end was that hacking, the insertion of attacks, some kind of attack software program, was the risk to be most concerned about because it could affect so many votes. And essentially, what we found is that there are so many places where software is created and inserted into the machine that it's probably impossible to prevent somebody who really wants to do damage to a vote count total from doing it. But what you can do is, if you have the right procedures in place, you can make sure that some kind of hacking or attack this way is caught. So in the end, I think that provides some comfort that these machines can be accurate if we have the right procedures in place. We made a number of recommendations to make these machines more secure. And the first recommendation was to audit voter verified paper records. There's been a long-standing debate since these machines started getting adapted in a widespread way about whether or not there should be a voter-verified paper record. And what we found is that in some ways that's the wrong debate to be having. The mere fact of having a voter-verified paper record by itself isn't necessarily going to make the machines more secure. if you're looking at the paper on a regular basis afterwards, and if you're conducting an audit, you're checking the paper that the voter has looked at against the electronic record, and you're taking a statistically significant sample in a truly random way, you don't need to look at that many of the votes to feel fairly confident that the electronic record is accurate. There's been this debate about paper, no paper. There are 35 states now that have voter-verified paper records, either by virtue of law they have to, or that's what all of the counties in the state have decided to purchase. So in that sense, the debate is over in 35 states, but only in about a dozen of those states are they actually regularly looking at the paper. So the fact that we have 35 states that have voter-verified paper records may or may not be a good thing, but unless they're taking that basic countermeasure of using the paper in the appropriate way, it won't necessarily provide that much more security. I should say the flip side of it is there are these 15 states that have either nowhere in the state or in many counties in their states don't have voter-verified paper records with their machines. That means, you know, basically they have touchscreen or ATM-style voting machines. There's no paper record that the voter can see to make sure that her vote was recorded correctly. In those states, it doesn't mean that there aren't things that can be done to make the systems more secure. One of our basic recommendations is that jurisdictions do something called parallel testing. And that's pulling, basically it's like a paperless audit, pulling machines at random on election day, voting on them as if it were a real election, and making sure that what comes out of those machines is actually what was inputted. It's not perfect. It probably doesn't provide as much security as having a paper record and auditing that paper record. But certainly for the states and counties that don't have voter-verified paper records on the machines, that's something at the very least that should be doing. And unfortunately, again, in those 15 states, very few jurisdictions right now are doing what they should to make those systems as secure as possible.
About 175 million Americans are registered to vote this November 7th. So just how many of them will be voting on optical scan and touchscreen machines?
Since the Help America Vote Act was passed in 2002, jurisdictions have been buying basically one of two or three systems, depending on how you identify them. But one system is the optical scan machine, and that's where a voter fills out her ballot with a pen or a pencil and fills in bubbles that represent each candidate and then has the ballot scanned into a scanner, and it's read electronically. That is, in a way, an electronic voting machine, and slightly over 40% of voters in 2004 will vote on that kind of a machine. I should say, those machines have shown themselves to be vulnerable to hacking as well. Harry Hursty did a hack on that kind of a system in Florida. And then there are the touchscreen machines. And those are, I think, what most people think of when they think of electronic voting. Some of those have voter-verified paper records. It's like a receipt that the voter can look at through a glass or plastic window and see their choices printed out. And those records are kept by the jurisdiction, and afterwards, if they want to, the jurisdiction can check the electronic totals against the paper records and make sure that they match up. Some of those touchscreens, like in Maryland and Georgia and in some other places, have no voter-verified paper records. So it's like an ATM machine, but there's basically no receipt. There's no printed record that the voter looks at and confirms represents her vote. I should say, in 2006, I think that's going to be about 40% of people are going to vote on those machines. If I'm not mistaken, Connecticut hasn't fully made its way over to either optical scan or touchscreen machines, and there are a couple of other states that haven't fully made that transformation. But over 80% of the country will vote on one of these two machines.
This isn't the first time Americans have had to confront security issues at the ballot box. Allegations of voter fraud date back almost to the days of the Founding Fathers. The clamor for the current e-voting technology became more widespread after the Hanging Chad incident in Florida and during the 2004 campaign, which witnessed some problems with the new technology, from unfamiliar poll workers, insufficient machines, and allegations of fraud.
In a way, this is a story of history repeating itself, and it's a kind of a very American phenomenon, a belief that technology can solve all problems. In the late 19th century, there were lots of frauds that were being committed against paper ballots. There was Tammany Hall in New York and other political machines in other cities like Chicago that were using paper to stuff ballots, to create ballots that didn't have all the right information on them, to make sure that the machine candidates got elected. At that time, the thought was we can solve these problems by creating voting machines. That's when we first started getting lever machines and eventually the punch card machines that were used in Florida and caused so many problems in 2000. And I should say the lever machines themselves had, there are many allegations that there's been fraud against those machines as well in the past 100 years. In any case, as we all know, in 2000, there were all kinds of problems, and many of the problems that these machines had long had were exposed because the election was so close and because every vote mattered. The response on the part of Congress was, we need to solve this problem. They passed the Help America Vote Act, and there were already some of these electronic voting machines being used in a few jurisdictions, so they easily addressed these problems without a new, better system having to be developed. They were there. And so many jurisdictions, including many counties in Florida, immediately purchased these electronic voting machines, touchscreen machines in particular. Now, I should say, in many ways, electronic voting machines did solve the problems that we identified in 2000. There are no more hanging chads. It is, in many ways, easier to tell what a voter's intention was with current electronic voting machines. And not all, but in some of the systems, there's no question that things like undervotes happen much less often. That's when somebody accidentally skips a race, or overvotes, where somebody accidentally votes for two candidates. Those happen much less often on many electronic voting systems than they did on punch card or lever machines. So those problems were solved. The problem, of course, is that technology can solve some problems, but it's not going to solve all problems, and often it will create new ones. And unless you have the right procedures in place, no matter what system you're using, the right procedures for that system, there are going to be potentially some problems. And I think that's where we find ourselves now. We went through this massive transformation, unprecedented in our history, where basically the entire country now, with the exception of New York, because we're behind, in just 4 or 5 years, has transformed how they're voting. And we didn't necessarily adapt the right procedures for those machines. We're starting to. The fact that there are 35 states now that have voter-verified paper records, I think, that would have been unimaginable just 2 years ago. That has been in reaction to fears about security, and I should say security and reliability are related. They're kind of the opposite sides of the same coin. But that's just one step. Having voter-verified paper records isn't really enough. In fact, I would argue that just that by itself doesn't really do anything unless you have other procedures in place. And we're starting to see in many states those other procedures being put in place because people are more and more aware that we have some catching up to do to make sure that these machines are what we want them to be.
A shortage of trained poll workers may have contributed to the problems with the machines in 2004 and remains a concern for the 2006 midterms.
One of the reasons that I think we saw such long lines in many counties in Ohio was because you had voters using these machines for the first time and they weren't familiar with them. I think another problem, unfortunately, in Ohio is that the machines weren't where they necessarily should have been. There were not enough machines in certain precincts. Part of that may have been that there was no experience in using the machines. There may have been other reasons as well, but certainly that may have been part of it. You know, one of the things that jurisdictions are struggling with, and I've been dealing with some counties in New York now that are looking at purchasing new machines, is when you buy a new machine, it may not be able to handle as many voters as your previous machine. So you may have to buy two or three of them, whereas in the past you only had one lever machine or only one punch card machine. I think that's certainly part of what the problems were in Ohio. And you know, I mean, in 2006, in the primaries, we've continued to see problems with these machines. Again, I think because there's not that much experience with them. We saw them in Maryland last month when it was basically not having the right procedures in place, not bringing the right memory cards for the machine so they couldn't start them up, and not having emergency paper ballots available so that even if the machines didn't start up, people were able to vote. That was something that when we were surveying counties for our report, we saw last spring it was going to be a potential problem. I think a lot of election officials, when they purchased these new electronic voting machines, and in particular the touchscreen machines, thought we don't have to deal with paper anymore. And paper is a very difficult thing to deal with. There are lots of reasons not to like paper. But when the machines don't work, there needs to be something that people can vote on. Unfortunately, I hope this has changed since what happened in Maryland. I don't know. But a lot of counties that we spoke to, you know, had five emergency ballots or no emergency ballots in their polling place in case of a machine failure. And there have been other problems as well. You know, there in the last primary in Cuyahoga County in Ohio, this is in 2006, you had all kinds of problems with the printers on the touchscreen machines where they were jamming, where the paper was put in the wrong way, so because of the way they're designed, the voter verified paper record wasn't showing any votes because the paper that's used is thermal paper, and if it's put the wrong way, the print from the printer doesn't show up. A lot of it, I think, is an experience. Poll workers didn't have experience to put the paper in the right way to make sure that they were doing things right, and actually voters didn't have experience to know that something was wrong, that there was a tape that should have been showing their votes and wasn't. Obviously, since this happened to a lot of voters, voters weren't notifying poll workers that there was something wrong with the printer and it needed to be corrected.
One of the largest companies in the electronic voting machine marketplace is Canton, Ohio-based Diebold Incorporated, a maker of ATM machines. The company has been under attack lately from a variety of sources who claim their systems are subject to hacking and possible voter fraud. Diebold spokesman Mark Radke says e-voting has been around longer than his company and that the technology has a track record for safety.
Diebold makes both a touchscreen voting station and also an optical scan unit as well. For those that are familiar with Diebold, Diebold is a very large corporation, and we've been in business for almost 150 years. And we have some extensive engineering resources, and much of that talent was used, in addition to designated talent for the election systems business, to develop the AccuVote TSX, which and also the AccuVote TS and the AccuVote OS, which is the optical scan system. Diebold has approximately 35 to 40% of the overall electronic voting machine. We officially entered the marketplace in January of 2002. Of course, the Florida 2000 election sparked the Help America Vote Act, and of course, the change in technology through a large portion of the country. Because of that, again, we looked at the similarities between the ATM and the voting terminal and saw a number of similarities. And because of that, we thought it was a very interesting market for us as well. Our sales have been very good. We have gained significant market share since entering the market. And quite honestly, even though we make up about 4% of the overall revenue of the corporation, our division has been very successful. Actually, it was well before our time in the marketplace. Electronic voting dates back about 20 years. And in fact, a person very well versed in electronic voting, Dr. Michael Seamus, has indicated that electronic voting has been in the market for 20 years and there's not a single validated case of a security breach in that entire length of time. You know, in a sense, it's new in some areas of the country, but again, electronic voting has been out there for about 20 years now. What's interesting is if you look back at when lever systems were being implemented in some areas of the country, and this goes back many years ago, you hear almost the same type of quotations as far as the fear and some of the anguish of selected individuals because of new technology being introduced. So this is not unique to touchscreen voting at all. I will tell you, though, that voters that use our equipment, in fact, we have about 1,000 customers all throughout the nation, and they use, of course, the touchscreen system and the optical scan system. And we have had tremendous loyalty with our customers. And quite honestly, the voters have liked the equipment very much as well. In fact, many surveys indicate that voters, again, find it very intuitive. They like the process. And again, they're very comfortable and confident in the results of the system. In fact, I think voters can be very confident that when they use our touchscreen and optical scan systems, that they really ensure that every vote is counted during election day.
Yet Norden says that's not enough and doesn't want to be in a position to have to rely solely on a company's promise that its systems are safe.
I'm glad that Diebold thinks that its product is safe, but frankly, when you're talking about our elections, I don't think that that's enough. Certainly, Ed Felton's study at Princeton, his hacking the Diebold machine was disturbing, although I don't think surprising. And I think he would tell you that this is something, and this is certainly something that we concluded in our study, that maybe not the exact same hack, but similar hacks are almost certainly possible on every vendor's machine. And again, this is the nature of the architecture of these machines. It's the fact that they run on a lot of software. It's the fact that there are many software inputs on these machines. You have to have valid definition files and other ways of getting information into the system. There are software updates and software that's coming from many sources. And no matter how rigorous, and certainly we should have a more rigorous certification process for these machines, but no matter how rigorous it is, anybody can tell you that has worked in computer science that there's always the potential for viruses, for hacking. And not just viruses and hacking, for software bugs, for misprogramming, which is, for all of the talk of hacking, unfortunately, if you have a paperless system, if it was done cleverly enough, it would be difficult to know that it happened. We certainly know, though, that there have been many programming errors over the past few years. The reason that we know them is because they didn't come out with particularly subtle results. They came out with, you know, an extra 100,000 votes in the tally server, or the Libertarian candidate getting the Democrats' votes, so that it was obvious that it happened. But if there's a bug or a hack that is more subtle, that might not be found unless we're taking the right steps to find it.
Diebold's Radke counters that the systems are safe and have gone through rigorous research and development, and that the concerns raised by the Princeton study and other incidents of possible security flaws are unfounded.
Well, first of all, I think there might be a little misunderstanding of the architecture of the system, because every touchscreen voting station is a standalone unit. It's never connected to the internet, nor is it networked internally. First of all, with the system itself, when you cast your ballot is immediately encrypted, and it's encrypted using Advanced Encryption Standard, which is a 128-bit form of encryption, and it's also stored in two locations within the system. So in case, for some reason, a memory card is lost or something happens to that memory card, you always have a backup as far as capturing the votes from that station. It goes to internal non-volatile flash memory and also to a memory card, which is non-volatile flash memory as well. Each unit does have its own battery backup, so if you lose battery and you lose your AC power, you still do not lose votes. Your votes are secure and accurately stored. In addition to that, the memory cards are digitally signed, so if anyone should try and tamper with the contents of the memory card, it's going to be immediately recognized. In addition to that element, all the passwords in the system are also dynamic, so they can be changed for every election, if need be, by the jurisdiction. 70% of all the Diebold touchscreen units that will be used in November have a paper audit trail, or a voter-verified paper audit trail, as it's called in the industry. And also, obviously, the optical scan units that are used would have the paper ballots, so 100% of those would have the paper backup as well. The Princeton paper, we see that as certainly not a real-world analysis of the system, because the election procedures that are in place at every jurisdiction were not considered during that analysis. Diebold has actually supplied our entire system, including software, source code, everything, to outside testing organizations. And they have gone through the entire system and come back and said it's safe and secure for voters to use. Now, they've taken into consideration, obviously, that there are layers of security involved at each jurisdiction, and also you have election officials from all different parties that are working side by side to implement the election. We feel that's very important, and that was neglected, I think, in many of the outside studies that were done.
Radke also notes that the recent stories of voting machine programming disks falling onto a desk in Maryland and the recent claims of hacking the machine with a simple hotel minibar key fail to take into account the security inherent in the voting system itself.
Basically, I'll quote Dr. Seamus once again. Basically, he said it was essentially meaningless that those disks were found. And I have to agree with him. And the reason I state that is because, first of all, two of the disks couldn't even be opened because of PGP encryption on the two disks. And even if they were, all the passwords, encryption keys, and all the security enhancements can be changed for every election by the jurisdiction. So the fact that that software was found really doesn't affect the security of elections whatsoever. First of all, there are poll workers in every precinct location watching the voter. In addition to that, there are tamper-evident tapes that go over the keyhole and also the door area. So if anyone would tamper with that door, it would immediately be recognized, and the results of that unit would be pulled from operation because of that. again, this is one of the series of layered security elements that are in place at every jurisdiction that were not recognized in those reports.
And Radke adds there are benefits to electronic voting.
The most significant attributes of electronic voting is the fact that it virtually eliminates voter error. If you look at Maryland as an example, the state of Maryland, they were the most accurate voting system in 2004. If you compare the voter error statistics from 2004 against the 2000 statistics, they had a 40% drop, reduction in voter error after they went implemented touchscreen voting equipment in 2002 and 2004. Georgia had the second worst voter error statistic at 3.5% during the 2000 election. They switched to our touchscreen system in 2002. In 2004, their voter error reduced to 0.39% from 3.5%. That meant that over 103,000 additional votes were counted correctly because of the implementation of touchscreen voting. The blind and physically challenged voters, again, now have full accessibility to the voting station without assistance. Again, the Help America Vote Act has that as a requirement, and it's a long time coming. Now they can actually enter the voting location and navigate through the entire ballot and cast their ballot, again, without assistance, which is a phenomenal feat for many of these people who always had to have someone come with them to the voting booth in the past. And again, I can't stress it enough that, again, voters, when they use our touchscreen and optical scan equipment, basically are assured that every vote will be counted on election day.
So what is driving this concern about this new technology and the companies that make it? Is it the technology itself and our rapid adoption of it without a procedure in place of checks and balances?
Well, I think one of the reasons that this has become such an issue is, number one, we've moved to these new systems, and there are all kinds of new problems when you move to new systems. But the other is, frankly, and I mean, this is what caused this whole thing to happen in the first place, is we're a very divided nation at this point, and there are a lot of close races. One thing I would say that I think is very important for Election Day is that voters be aware of what their role is in making sure that there aren't problems with these machines. To the extent that a voter sees that a candidate is missing from the screen or the ballot, that when she presses for one candidate, another shows up on the confirmation screen, that the voter verified paper record actually isn't printing, or that the paper printer is jammed, to avoid other voters getting disenfranchised, it's incredibly important that when voters see these problems, that they report them and make sure that they're corrected before anybody else votes on the machines.
Anytime you change technology, again, there's a learning curve associated with that, whether it's from paper to lever systems or any other type of technology. So training is essential, and it is very important that the election officials, the poll workers, and also the voters through voter outreach are comfortable with the technology. And what's interesting and I think very important about this upcoming November election is that every one of the jurisdictions running Diebold's equipment will have at least used the equipment once before. So again, people will be much more, much well-versed concerning the operation of the equipment.
And what about the politics of e-voting? Radke says Diebold has taken extensive steps to avoid any possibility of a conflict of interest.
Diebold has an ethics policy that restricts all of our top executives and also anyone associated with Diebold Election Systems, basically restricts them from any fundraising activities whatsoever. I believe we're the only company in the industry that has that that type of ethics policy.
While Norden applauds Diebold's steps to assure the security of their machines and shield them from any conflict of interest from its employees, he thinks there's an expanded role that Congress should play to guarantee an election free from fraud.
There is a bill that Congressman Holt introduced in the House that now I think is co-sponsored by 219 members in the House, which is half, I guess, half the House. And that would do a lot of the things certainly that we have recommended. It would make auditing of voter-verified paper records mandatory. It would make sure that there aren't wireless components that can send and receive radio frequencies on voting machines. And it would do a number of other things that would be important to making the systems more secure. I think that there is a growing awareness, I think, in Congress that something has to be done. Unfortunately, neither the Holt bill or any other bill will be able to do anything in time for this election. but perhaps for 2008. I don't want Congress to compound a mistake that it made. I think 2002, the Help America Vote Act did a lot of good things, but it was done in such a hurry. We're now in some ways reaping the consequences of that. But I think that there are some very clear things that Congress can do, like make sure that every state is checking voter verified paper records against the electronic record, that those audits are done in a random way so that we know, in a statistically significant way, so that we can really have confidence that the electronic record total is correct. Making sure that there is no expansion of use of wireless components on voting machines, which we found could be a dangerous thing, is certainly something that I would like to see taken care of. There are other things that Congress can encourage or require jurisdictions to do in terms of having the right procedures. It can also pressure the EAC, the Election Assistance Commission. Number one, do the kinds of threat analysis that we did at the Brennan Center so that the guidelines for voting systems actually say what threats they're addressing. That doesn't exist right now. So we have all kinds of guidelines, but we don't necessarily say what threats against voting systems they're dealing with. I think it would be very helpful to election officials to understand why having certain procedures in place deals with certain threats and what threats aren't being dealt with by the guidelines.
As America gets ready to go to the polls this Tuesday and test out these new systems, what can they expect in the years to come in voting technology? Both Norden and Radke shared their views.
If you talk to election officials today, many of them will say, when you ask them about internet voting, they'll say, oh, maybe 15 years from now, because of obviously identification issues associated with that. Is that really who is on the other end of the internet voting? I mean, there's a question mark there unless biometrics comes into play. Also, the security of the internet has also been questioned by some election officials. So I think from an internet standpoint, we're probably looking at least 15 years or so before that becomes a reality in the United States. Overseas, though, we're starting to see more and more interest in that. Actually, we just introduced a product last year called the Electronic Poll Book, and that product basically replaces the paper poll book that's used within the precinct location. And it saves considerable cost and manpower following the election because the voter history can be uploaded into the voter registration system very, very quickly and eliminates weeks and weeks of manual labor. Again, we've got 1,000 customers out there that have used our product, in some cases for many years, and certainly stand behind it. People overall seem excited about electronic voting. Of course, that's not everyone, but the vast majority do. And we certainly seeing it continuing. And just like when ATMs were introduced as an example, it took people a while to warm up to that that technology. And we see the same thing happening here in some respects with electronic voting. People using our system can certainly be confident it's going to work correctly, accurately, and securely.
In the near term, the thing is, the way I see voting going is getting better procedures in place for these machines. In terms of the long term, things like voting by the internet or voting from home, certainly anything we can do to make voting easier for people is potentially a very good thing. But I think most computer scientists and most security experts at this point believe that there is no way to do that without it being tremendously insecure. There's a lot of talk about having voting machines protected by some kind of cryptographic technology to make them more secure from hacking. And there's a lot of talk about some other kind of independent verification of voters' votes other than paper. Like a video camera, perhaps, or something. There are privacy issues associated with that. One other thing I should say is we're already seeing developments in the printers for these touchscreen machines. I've seen in New York and in New Jersey, because they're a little bit further behind, the kinds of printers that they're looking at. And in many ways, they seem to be a vast improvement over the older printers that a lot of other states have right now that tend to jam a lot more, that don't separate one ballot from the next, but are just kind of on this long reel, which leads to paper jams and all other kinds of problems. So that's an immediate kind of improvement that I see potentially coming out. My final thoughts are that electronic voting, there's a lot of potentially good that could come out of it. There are 40 million Americans approximately that are disabled, and many of them now, for the first time, can vote independently on electronic voting. And there's work to be done on that, but that's something that, you know, with the old lever machines and punch card machines, we were not able to do before. Again, there are electronic voting machines. Many of them more accurately record voters' intentions than the old punch cards and lever machines. But we have to be aware that the country has gone through a massive transformation in the past 4 years. When that kind of a technological transformation happens, we have to be prepared to make procedural changes as well and to rethink our old habits around voting. And there shouldn't be resistance to that. I think to a large degree that resistance has disappeared across the country, but it still exists to a certain extent. And I don't think that's good for anybody. I think recognizing that we have this new technology and we need new procedures is the best way to make sure that these machines deliver on the promise that was the reason that we started moving to them in 2002.
My thanks to my two guests, Mark Radke of Canton, Ohio-based Diebold Incorporated, maker of optical scan and touchscreen voting machines that many Americans will use in this Tuesday's election, and Larry Norden, associate counsel of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU's School of Law, for his expert analysis of the e-voting machine controversy. We'll have many weeks and months ahead to distill the effects of these machines in local and national races. And we'll cover that and more right here at Podtech News. In Los Angeles, I'm Matt Kelly.
Gaming consoles are sort of a cult object. There's a problem that many gamers are facing right now. What to buy? A Sony PlayStation 3, a Nintendo Wii, or the already released Microsoft Xbox 360? Podtech's Rio Pacino attempts to answer this question in a series of interviews with gaming journalists who've had extensive experience with the next-gen consoles. In this week's podcast, we give you the top reasons to either buy or not buy the Wii.
This has got to be my favorite moment as a gamer when the new next-gen consoles come out. It's a rare moment in video game history. It only happens every couple of years. We had the Xbox 360 debut last year. Now we have the Nintendo Wii and the Sony PlayStation 3 set to launch in less than a month. Now, to commemorate this momentous occasion, we have put together a report on the top reasons to buy these next-gen consoles, and for this week's podcast, we will preview the Nintendo Wii. I had a chance to speak with Ryan Garside, who is a reviews editor for UK-based BitTech.net. He was invited by Nintendo to play the system hands-on at Nintendo's headquarters, and I asked him why we should or should not buy the Wii.
First reason has to be that the Wii is a Nintendo product, and for the last, well, over 20 years, Nintendo have been releasing high-quality products. Well, actually, is it 20 years? Well, nearly 20 years, anyway. High-quality products that have got a massive fan base. And if you're a Nintendo fan, then the Wii is going to be, you know, it's the next big thing. It's a big leap forward.
Now, how big of a leap is it from the GameCube?
Well, in terms of graphics, I was disappointed by the Wii. I spent about 2 hours hands-on with the console, and I got to play a number of the games. And I don't see it as a huge leap from the GameCube. In comparisons to the 360 and the PS3, you just couldn't compare them. The Wii is far and away, so far behind. It doesn't have high definition. It doesn't work with high definition TVs. I mean, it does work with them, but you don't get high def content. And it's not going to be graphically impressive. However, the Nintendo representative had informed me and told me that the main strategy of the Nintendo Wii is gameplay. Is the gameplay as radical and brilliant as Nintendo are actually making it out to be? I draw a question mark over that statement that Nintendo are trying to put across.
How about the price for the Wii? Sony PlayStation 3 is priced at $499 and $599. The Xbox 360, which is already out, is priced at $299 and $399. The price has to be a big positive as well for Nintendo.
Price point is a lot lower than either of the two other competitors, PS3 or the 360. And essentially, that's going to be a big drawing point for a lot of people. You are going to get a console that in Britain will retail for £179. I'm not sure of the US price, but essentially that's a lot cheaper than the other consoles. However, this also has a flip side. Once you get your Wii, it will come bundled with only one Wii remote. Most people won't want to play the Nintendo Wii on their own. It's designed to be a sociable console. It's designed to be played with friends. And so you're looking, at least in England, to be spending an extra £30, that's $60. I'm not sure what the translation prices are, but that's $60 on another Wii remote when you bought the console. So already the price of the console is actually creeping up. So yes, it is a cheap console, but you have to look at the extra factors of how much you're going to pay for kind of the Wii remotes and other extra peripherals to make this an experience as it's meant to be played. So it's a good price point, but there are other factors that people should consider.
And what are some of those other factors?
Other positive factors, the Nintendo, the Mii service, that I was particularly interested in the way they're going to run. I didn't actually get to see it, but the online element where you'll be able to download the Nintendo back catalogue, that will be very enticing for a lot of people. It is interesting to see how developers in the second generation of these games will actually come up with ways to tackle the console and get the most out of it. We're looking at a 360, the second generation now, and games like Gears of War. And that's really what a console is going to be judged on, how its second generation titles fare.
How about the games? You mentioned the games. A lot of people say it's not about the graphics. It's all about the games and the gameplay. What were your thoughts on the games that you played?
Well, what I'm going to say is, yes, the Wii gameplay is different to what you will get on a PS3 or a 360. However, is it as different as you actually might have thought reading articles in the past? I'd say probably not. The Wii, essentially, as far as I'm aware, from my experiences of it, are the controller reacts through movement, but the reactions that the controller makes and the way it works, it's simply a joypad that works through movement. I described it as a kind of a light gun, a mouse, and a joypad all rolled into one. So, for instance, when I got hands-on with it, if I moved it left, that could be like the button A. And if I moved it right, that was like the button B. And if I moved it up, that was like the button C. It wasn't how some people are expecting it to be, very dynamic and work smoothly with all your actions, at least not in the games that I played, which were Wii Sports, Legend of Zelda, and a few others. I wasn't hugely impressed with the gameplay elements. I expected something to be revolutionary, something new, something completely different. What I found was something that essentially a joypad in a infrared remote system. It's not as dynamic as you think, and it doesn't react in the way that you might expect. It isn't a magic wand. Essentially, it's a piece of technology that they're selling at low prices. It doesn't do magic things. So that is a negative way of looking at it. But on the positive side, okay, it does do a few different things, and, you know, this will get games out to, hopefully get it out to a bigger audience, which is what they're aiming for, with kind of getting families involved in playing games and getting your grandparents involved in playing games and that kind of thing. And that is definitely a positive aspect, if it works. And, of course, that remains to be seen. I don't know. I think gameplay, it can only really be judged when the games come out, when all of the journalists can kind of get their hands on them properly, see how big the games are, see how long they are, and really get to grips with, is this just a gimmick, or is this a real great piece of technology that is going to change everyone's lives? That's something that we will just have to wait and see.
Let's go ahead and talk about some more of the negative aspects of this system. I mean, a lack of HD compatibility has to be the biggest one.
Well, I think to the traditional gamer, graphics play a huge role. We're used to this idea that every time we buy and spend money on a new console, will get an update in the graphics and that it will look better. And it's a physical thing that we can look at and appreciate that we've spent money on something and we've got a better product. And your basic John Doe character will be able to look at that and say, yes, this is a better computer. I'm glad I bought my 360 and I can get rid of my Xbox. So graphics, I think, are an important factor to the traditional gamer. But what Nintendo are trying to say is we want to attract in the people who might not have played games so much in the past. And so will graphics be as important to those guys? And the answer is probably not. Ultimately, if the games work well, like WarioWare, for instance, which works brilliantly, and I can't imagine any game being better for kids, there is no need for the graphics to be brilliant and amazing. However, for games like Zelda, I need a real reason to go and buy a Wii to play Zelda over and above my GameCube, and the graphics just don't provide me with that reason. It looks, it suffers with no anti-aliasing, so all the edges are very blur. They don't look defined, and it looks jagged and blocky, and it just doesn't look very nice. And so, yeah, I think that could be a big impact as well. When you walk into game stores and you see the computers all lined up alongside each other, people do look at them and they do see the graphics and they do make an immediate impact. And the Nintendo Wii at the moment, the Nintendo Wii just doesn't have that power to provide that graphical oomph, or at least I haven't seen it in the games that I've looked at. One argument against that would be that Resident Evil 4, when it came out not so long ago for the GameCube.
Right, it was a beautiful, beautiful game.
It showed how much can be done with the GameCube, and perhaps later games on the Wii will kind of stretch its power. But at the moment, the game didn't look brilliant. They didn't look breathtaking, and they were nowhere near what you would see on a 360 or a PS3. So the negatives of the Wii are is gameplay. Is the way the Wii Remote works going to be as brilliant and revolutionary as people are hoping it's going to be? Are people going to be disappointed when they open up their Wii console, stick it on their TV, and they get to grips with it, and they realize maybe this isn't as brilliant as I expected it to be? My feeling is that is how a lot of people are going to end up feeling, because ultimately it's not a magic wand. This is a piece of technology that performs a function, and yes, it's different to a joypad in some respects, but ultimately it does what a joypad has done. My other fear and the other negative is the Wii could end up being just a gimmick. Whether it's going to take off and become part of our family lives like Nintendo are hoping it's going to be, and at family events we'll be playing it and so on and so forth, it remains to be seen. There is a reason why older people don't pick up technology as well as younger people, and it's because it seems alien and it seems frightening to them. I mean, you know, my grandparents sometimes struggle to turn on the TV, you know, and that's just purely it's a case of age, and trying to convince those people that they want to play a computer game when they're 60, 70 years old, I don't see happening. But ultimately, it's going to produce cheaper games, and that is going to be a big positive for it, because low-price games are going to be attractive to mums and dads, and that is always going to be a big pull. When the mum walks into Walmart and she sees a game that's priced half the price of the other games, that's always going to be, you know, a big selling point. So that kind of sums it up.
There you have it. Those are the top reasons we should or shouldn't buy a Nintendo Wii. From Ryan Garside, reviews editor for bit-tech.net, who had his personal hands-on experience with the system at Nintendo headquarters. And make sure to tune in next week, where we'll have the top reasons to or not to buy a Sony PlayStation 3. This is Rio Pacino for podtech.net.
This has been PodTech Weekly, a production of PodTech.net, created by editor Michael Klinger, reporters Matt Kelly, Clark Boyd, Catherine Girardeau, and Rio Pacino. I'm Jason Lopez.